Thank you, Rana. And also, again, I would like to express my thanks to all three of the curator organizers of the event and to all the staff at the house for their hospitality. Okay. Dear you, I am here in Echo. The soldiers tell me that you refuse to meet with me. I don't trust them. If you really don't want to talk with me, please tell me briefly why in a written note and sign it so I know you wrote it. Thanks, M. A letter from a lawyer to a client in prison. This prisoner is a prisoner of war who isn't a prisoner of war, otherwise known as an illegal alien enemy combatant. In December of 2014, a colleague of mine sent me a very large collection of written and image files, close to 1,000 items, that had been given to her by one of the attorneys, not the one who's sitting here, had been given to me by one of the attorneys working with some of the Yemeni prisoners in Guantanamo. This letter was among them. The attorney who gave her the files wanted someone to write something to make more public the men's stories and their experiences. At the time, the situation needed kind of, again, attention. There was another large hunger strike in April of 2013, provoked in part over the situation of the then 56 prisoners from Yemen, cleared for release but stuck because of the 2009 ban on releasing them. Subsequently, as you might know, men from Yemen released from Guantanamo, just 12, for example, this past August, are barred from returning home and are sent as exiles elsewhere, primarily to the United Arab Emirates, where they are basically under house arrest. The idea was that I would write something with these letters and documents, there's thousands of them, focusing on the men's stories. But nothing has happened with all this, and some ordinary work scheduling issues are partially the reason I was finishing another book, but also because for me, this cache of documents raised a series of questions about what kind of archive I might find in them, what significance or meaning was there and for whom, and what would then be the best means for representing or translating that significance. I don't have the answers to those questions to give to you now, today, but rather I want to try to think aloud about how I might find them, and in the course of which hopefully contribute something to the conversation. I've been studying captivity and confinement for a long time now in different contexts, trying to understand the socioeconomic political goals it serves, while at the same time trying to excavate and learn what I've called the radical methodology of imprisonment that prisoners practice, which produces a subversive knowledge of the prison regime itself, and also a knowledge of how it's possible to live in that space of death, dispossession, and disenfranchisement. As you probably know, starting in the early 1970s and reaching its nadir by the turn of the 21st century, the US built the largest prison system in the world. Along with many others, I was trying to understand and also stop the system of mass imprisonment that often goes by the name the prison industrial complex when the global war on terror was launched in 2001. Quite quickly, it seemed that US military imprisonment, hitherto a rather small operation primarily oriented to confining soldiers for desertion, mutiny, treason, or disorderly conduct, would become a crucial military tactic or technology for waging the war on terror. And in fact, it did. In 2005, the BBC estimated that 60,000 individuals had already been taken prisoner in the US-led wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and while most of those individuals were released, the US did indeed build a vast military carceral complex. The base at Guantanamo contained 6 units or prisons holding originally around 800 men. In Iraq and Afghanistan, there were thousands of people imprisoned in dozens of facilities, some acknowledged, some black sites, several of which were large, new, modern, super maximum facilities built to purpose. The significance of the military prison remained in the background until the publication in 2004 of the photographs of the torture of Iraqi prisoners held at Abu Ghraib, when those photographs galvanized public awareness about the prisons and what was happening to the people in them. The moral outrage that many people felt was certainly understandable, and the public media attention to the prisoners of the War on Terror was warranted and important. However, too much of that attention treated the conditions at Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo, and at the other prisons as exceptional, extra-legal, or isolated instances of the abuse of state power. However, from the point of view of U.S. prison abolition activists, as Mumia Abul-Jamal bluntly put it, and I quote him, "If you're African or Native American, how central torture is to the American way of life is hardly a new idea." In fact, virtually simultaneous to the publication of the Abu Ghraib photographs, Mark Dow published his harrowing exposé of the secret, indefinite, and repressive imprisonment of immigrants, entitled American Gulag, Inside U.S. Immigration Prisons. And in May 2006, when the Bush administration appeared before the UN Committee Against Torture to answer questions about the secret detention, treatment, and illegal rendition of prisoners of the War on Terror, 20 shadow reports were filed by U.S. NGOs, including the 450-page entitled In the Shadows of the War on Terror, Persistent Police Brutality and Abuse in the United States, by the American Friends Service Committee, the Quakers. Dow's book, these reports and others were important reminders of what and who was being forgotten in the shock and outrage, and they were also, in some instances, genuine attempts to create a basis of solidarity and cross-issue organizing in the wake of rising anti-Muslim sentiment and policies. I began to examine the relationship between the U.S. military prisons abroad and the territorial civilian prisons because I felt that the relationship was obscured and yet was developing in ways that needed to be understood to deal with the dehumanizing condition of all prisoners held by the United States and to grapple with some of the larger socio-political issues at stake. And so in a series of articles, I tried to show that the connection between the U.S. military prison and the U.S. civilian prison operated at four overlapping levels involving personnel, the punishment regime, law, and geopolitics, which I will summarize. At the first and most basic level, the connection began with the literal sharing of personnel. The military prison was not equipped to take on the job it had been given, either in terms of numbers or experience, and it met that demand by using civilian prison guards serving in the Army Reserve and by appointing U.S. prison managers and directors to build the new military prisons and to run them. You might recall that Ivan Frederick and Charles Grainer were both convicted of beating and humiliating Iraqi prisoners, and also that they were prison guards, Frederick in Virginia and Grainer at the Supermax facility in Western Pennsylvania, SCI Green, where he had been implicated repeatedly in violence against prisoners, and in fact where Mumia Abul-Jamal was then on death row. The two were but one example of a much larger set of personnel connections. The 300th Military Police Brigade, the majority of whom were Michigan prison guards, designed Camp Delta at Guantanamo, while the senior non-commissioned officer of the brigade was John Venata, then superintendent of the Miami Correctional Facility in the state of Indiana. John Armstrong in 2004, the assistant director of operations of American prisons in Iraq, was the head of Connecticut's Commission of Corrections from 1995 to 2003, et cetera, et cetera. In general, U.S. prisons are highly militarized with vertical command structures, obedience norms, and paranoid us-them cultures, virtually indistinguishable from soldiering. Prisons are violent places in the United States with complex and institutionally specific racial classification systems that organize daily life for prisoners and in which the use of lethal force is routine. Sophisticated weaponry and surveillance systems, shackles and cages, constant gun cover, sensory deprivation and sensory overload, arbitrary orders, playing sticks and carrots. This is the normal punishment regime in civilian U.S. prisons. And it was this punishment regime that was imported into the new and expanding military prison system in a context that was chaotic, lots of to do quickly by people with little experience or oversight, but who had unlimited funds and unlimited prerogative. Although most people did not see it this way, what the Abu Ghraib photographs exposed was not exceptional, but rather the modus operandi of the lawful, modern, state-of-the-art U.S. civilian prison. In other words, it was the normalcy of exceptional brutality, a shared punishment regime that was the second point, or is the second point of connection between military and civilian imprisonment. The legal justifications for the prosecution of the war on terror and the kidnapping and indefinite detention of prisoners of war are complex, and they became even more complicated with the Military Commission Acts of 2006 and 2009. I'm pretty sure that Ramzi can speak more knowledgeably about this than I can, so I might shunt it over to him. I merely want to make a more limited point here, and that point is that the prisoner with restricted access to independent legal counsel, held incommunicado in secretive locations inaccessible to the public, charged with violating internal bureaucratic rules, promised trials adjudicated by the very authorities who hold them, legally limited in their right to stand before the law independent of their captors, this prisoner was as readily found, is as readily found in the U.S. as they were in Afghanistan, Iraq, or in Cuba today. Perceptive U.S. prisoners knew this, as did U.S. authorities, their intellectuals, and their lawyers. Throughout the 1980s and 1990s, the U.S. courts had actively disabled prisoners' civil and political rights at the behest of the Reagan and Clinton governments, and they also eroded, if not effectively ended, the Eighth Amendment protection against cruel and unusual punishment. As Colin Diane showed, the Supreme Court's Eighth Amendment cases, which turned punishments subject to judicial oversight into security measures administered by prison authorities, were the basis for the detainee interrogation memos prepared for the war on terror by the Bush attorneys. Those memos did not become law, but they did validate a social reality that was already settled in law and in practice in the civilian prison, where the power of the prison authority, the police, which will make sense why I say that in a minute, to maintain order and compliance, where the power of the prison authority, the police, to maintain order and compliance or security is absolute. Arguably, at the level of culture or ideology, if not law itself, that social reality made Geneva and the laws of war inoperable. The erosion of the distinction enshrined in the Eighth Amendment, perhaps constitutively flawed, between justifiable punishment and punishment that is degrading, arbitrary, unnecessary, and socially unacceptable, what is meant by cruel and unusual, has been tied to the production of a permanent prison population in the United States. Permanent not only in the sense of being always available, but permanent in the sense of perpetuity, of assigning to certain groups of people in the United States, blacks, Native Americans, Latinos, and increasingly Muslims, the caste and the stigmata of the perpetual prisoner. Orlando Patterson, in his analysis of the idiom of social death, expertly summarized how a society's outsiders, foreigners, infidels, prisoners of war, and a society's insiders, criminals, the destitute, rebels, could be conceived as a people who did not and could never belong. He wrote, and I quote, "The one fell because he was the enemy. The other became the enemy because he had fallen." Mass imprisonment is a form of organized abandonment in which targeted populations treated as surplus and disposable are abandoned by the state to the state, in other words, abandoned from one part of the state to another part of the state, warehoused and subject to a vast system of social control whose reach extends well beyond the prison walls. Mass imprisonment is a technology for managing racial capitalism's intrinsic inequalities and miseries, and it is also for managing the political unrest that those depredations engender, particularly in black communities suffering from rounds of regimes of abandonment and very long histories of both captivity and radicalism. In the U.S., mass imprisonment plays a central role in the perpetuation and expansion of a security war economy that is both extractive and highly repressive, and yet remains virtually unquestioned. We are now more than 15 years from the launch of the global war on terror. While President Obama officially retired the term, and the military use of imprisonment is momentarily in decline, although the fastest growing U.S. prison sector are the immigration prisons, which are administered by the Department of Homeland Security and are, for all intensive purposes, military prisons, I think it's fair to say that the global war on terror continues and has become what it threatened, a permanent general war without end, waged against ever-shifting enemies, driven by ideologies of order and counterinsurgency, and by policies to contain the effects of a predatory racial capitalism. In this war, the distinction between the internal and external enemy is fragile at best. In this war, the creation of both internal and external enemies depends now fundamentally on criminalization, ironically, in part, a consequence of President Bush's attempt to avoid the Geneva Convention and the international laws of war. Because, of course, remember, the one thing the prisoner of war is not is a criminal, unless they are charged with a specific war crime. In this war, the distinction between war out there, foreign, and war in here, domestic, or policing, and the legal and institutional worlds they inhabit remain, the distinctions remain, but it grows thin. The thinner it grows, the more important police power becomes. And I want to kind of, that's my last point, to say a word about police power. By police power, I don't mean only police officers or police departments and their more spectacular violence, violence assisted by expensive military hardware and counterinsurgency tactics. Police power is a mode of governance, the discretionary power to dispose of present threats to the social order and to avert future dangers to it. The responsibility of the power for the future is important. Predicting dangerousness is one of its main functions. Police power is always anticipatory in this sense, and its 17th and 18th century European theorists viewed it as a means to achieve the political ideal of a harmonious state, its interior affairs all in good order, a kind of civilizing paradigm, you could say. Settler colonial regimes have been especially propitious laboratories for the development of a police power capable of effectively expropriating and protecting private property, including racial property such as whiteness, and protecting social order, as the case of the United States or Israel clearly demonstrates. In the antebellum United States, police power was an explicitly racial privilege. The state did not, in fact, hold a monopoly on the use of force. Thus, the right of slave owners and their deputies, such as slave patrols and labor overseers, to police at will and to usurp the judicial power to punish. In principle, police power, modern police power, defers or cedes the power to punish to the judge, although this principle, constitutional in nature, has a rather checkered history, and one could argue that the prison, which concentrates police power, mocks the very principle itself. In the United States, this history has been passed down as the specific right of white property owners to exercise police power when threatened. Stand Your Ground, as it's colloquially known, was the legal grounds for the acquittal of George Zimmerman for killing Trayvon Martin, a death many people have heard of. The genealogy of those legal rights is to be found in the post-Civil War history of the Black Codes, convict leasing, and lynching. Whether the individual right to bear arms is constitutional precedent or merely a practical requirement for exercising police power is a question for a legal scholar to answer. Political history suggests that the insistence on the right to bear arms is usually in the service of a struggle over the exercise of police power. This was the case in the American Revolution against the British, and it was the position of the Black Panther Party, made explicit in May of 1967, when several members of the party attempted to enter the California State Capitol building to oppose passage of the Mulford Bill, which had been designed to effectively end the Black Panther police patrols. They were self-policing. Unable to enter the building, they were famously photographed holding their weapons on the steps of the Capitol building in advance of issuing a statement to this effect. More generally, this history has been passed down as the restricted authority to determine what and who is a threat to the terms of order. In other words, to create crimes and criminals. Of course, Black people are not by any means the only object of such condemnation, although they are rarely exempt from it. It's worth noting police departments obviously do the bidding of other masters. James Baldwin rightly called them the hired, quote, enemies of urban communities of color. And the price they charge is exemption from being policed, which they receive, save in those exceptional situations in which to save police power, an individual police officer might need to be sacrificed. It's for this reason that Nikhil Pal Singh uses the phrase, quote, the whiteness of police, whiteness signifying here not the ethnicity of the individual members of police forces, but the status that confers immunity from criminalization. To conclude, I would like to emphasize the extent to which police power does the work of racial ordering that the state has formally outlawed. And it's crucial to understand that today, racism, and certainly not only in the United States, operates precisely through the presumption that it no longer exists. And so I want to emphasize that, the extent to which police power does the work of racial ordering that the state has formally outlawed, and police power also does the work of maintaining security, of creating and managing the enemies of the state. The one fell because he was the enemy, the other became the enemy because he had fallen. Today, Americans live in a police state overseen by a confident, hyper-white nationalist government. This police state is very powerful. It is experienced in waging war, in creating internal and external enemies, and in protecting itself under cover of law, national myth, and various forms of sanctioned ignorance. This is, as I see it, a descriptive fact. It doesn't answer the question of what to do with the Yemeni men's stories or the larger archive of prisoner of war paperwork. What I've just said to you is sort of thick and clumsy. It can be refined for sure, but their stories are fragile and delicate, etched into a different density that is the bureaucracy, banality, and maddening quality of the prison. Those languages at some level are incommensurate. The meeting point is elsewhere. It is in, I think, the growing opposition to the police state as a way of life and what will become of it, an opposition in which many men and women held in US prisons also do their part from the inside. Thank you.